Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast, and today we are going to be talking about boys. What are they for, and what do they do, and how do they function in early modern drama and beyond? We're looking at boys' plays, boys' companies, boys in plays. It's a whole mashup of things that hopefully we're going to give a reasonable overview with my guest today, who is going to introduce themselves now. Who are you and what is your purpose in life?
Hello, I'm Harry McCarthy, and one of my purposes in life is to research boy actors. Last year, towards the end of last year, I published a book called Boy Actors in Early Modern England with Cambridge University Press. This is something that I've been interested in for quite a long time. The question of what boys are for, as you put it, and how they work in performance in this period.
Yes, because we have... because this is potentially a very wide-ranging discussion here, because as many of our listeners will know, it is standard practice for adult companies to have boy players to play primarily female roles. But there are also boys' companies, and there are many boys' companies, and they have an alternating history. Sometimes they appear, they sometimes disappear, sometimes they disappear under very awkward circumstances and then reappear very shortly after with a slightly different name. And there is a slightly confusing history, which hopefully we'll be able to unpack a little bit there. But also it's this question of boys in education, which overlaps with these boys' companies as well. So can you give me a sort of an overview, very brief overview, considering we go up to 1642, so anything before then. How boys function in the boys' companies that we're talking about mostly in the late 16th, early 17th century?
Yes, so the boys' companies kind of come in two waves, the first of which is the mid-1570s into the 1580s, the second, the end of the 1590s into the first decade and a bit beyond that of the 17th century. First of all, the boys' companies were primarily attached to choir schools, St. Paul's School and the Chapel Royal. And initially, it seems to be the case that performance and acting was part of their wider education. So as well as learning to sing, as your listeners will know, music and acting go hand in hand in this period and in actor training to this day. So there was a sense that performing in plays was in some ways good for the boy choristers as well as the schoolboys. Drama is a very important part of the curriculum, not as how we would envisage it in a school setting today, but more the grammar school classroom was a kind of very dramatic place in that boys were reading classical plays and learning to speak them. And the idea there was not to create a classroom full of actors, but to create a classroom for orators and rhetors. So the idea being that if you performed a play by Seneca or spoke a passage from Ovid's Metamorphoses, that you would then be able to replicate those kind of creative techniques in your own writing. So the schools and the choirs are kind of the founding impetus of these performances, but quite quickly, the boys' companies attached to St. Paul's predominantly start to move away from the essentially lie that this is a kind of informalized way of getting the boys better at learning, and it becomes a very commercial enterprise. So the company masters would charge members of the public fairly high prices to watch these boys perform in plays. And often those plays would ultimately then be performed at the court of Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth was very fond of having boy performers come and perform for her. And a lot of those performances were drawn from either the company that was attached to St. Paul's or also some of the surrounding grammar schools. So the Merchant Taylor's School in London and St. Paul's School would go and perform for the Queen. So the idea of having the public come to watch those was essentially a shared fiction that what the public was watching was a rehearsal of something that would be presented before the Queen. So it lends it an air of exclusivity. So that's the kind of founding wave of boy companies, which then kind of gets suppressed in the mid-1580s. There's no real consensus around the cutoff date, but they seem to have stopped performing somewhere around the 1580s. A lot of their plays then get put into print. Not all of them have survived. But the kind of founding corpus of those is, the central corpus of those is John Lilly's plays, which a lot of your listeners will be familiar with. And then the companies reemerge in 1599 and 1600. And then there are two competing companies, the Children of Paul's, attached to St. Paul's Choir and school. They seem to have drawn actors from both the choir and the school. And the Children of the Chapel, as they were originally known, they were then known as the Children of the Queen's Revels when James comes to the throne. And they receive a royal patent from Queen Anna, which they don't always manage to hang on to because they seem to be very fond of putting on plays that mocked the king or mocked the court. So eventually they too were suppressed and then got rearranged into another company which featured a lot of the same actors. So the Children of the Queen's Revels is how we tend to refer to that company after 1603, just for convenience, but they were not always receiving direct patronage from the Queen.
And it's interesting, even though there is this sort of gap between that shall we say, the Lilly phase in terms of the texts that come to us. We've done a number of looks on the YouTube channel at the Lilly corpus, and by the time this is released, more of them will be available to the public. There is interesting that there are interesting echoes when boys' companies return 10 or so years later, that there does seem to be some sort of emulation from some writers to do Lilly. And it's an interesting question: does Lilly return to the repertoire? How much of a continuity is there in boy playing, even with these big breaks? I mean, even if they're not performing to the public, are they still doing some sort of performance-based practice as part of their education? Is that still going on, or is it just what are we going to give to these boys after 10, 15 years away? Do we think there's a continuity under the surface that we're just not seeing?
I think there certainly is in terms of the educational practice. I think drama never went away from the classroom, particularly because you had figures, leading schoolmasters like Richard Mulcaster, who was the High Master of Merchant Taylor School and then St. Paul's School. So he had a hugely long teaching career at two very influential schools from which a lot of these actors were drawn. So he was a big advocate not only of performance in the classroom, but also of all kinds of physical education. So he writes this fantastic book in the 1580s called Positions Concerning the Training Up of Children. It has a much longer title than that, but there are individual chapters which extol the virtues of various activities like dancing, sword fighting, football, running, walking, and all of these kind of activities, many of which translate directly into the boy company plays because those actors are asked to do those particular things. So there's a sense that grammar school education is actually very good implicit training for the professional stage, even though those who founded grammar schools probably would never have wanted to think of it in that way. So there is that kind of continuity, I think, which is a lot harder to trace. But John Lilly's plays, one of them certainly, Love's Metamorphosis, makes its way back into the repertory in 1600. It's performed by the Children of the Chapel, or the Children of the Queen's Revels, probably in their first season. And in one of the plays that's written newly for that company, Ben Jonson's Cynthia's Revels in 1600, it begins with this fantastic induction, or preludium, as he calls it in his very kind of Latinate way, in which one of the boys impersonates a playgoer who talks about how the stage has been haunted by the ghosts of plays which have previously been performed. So even though we don't have particularly solid records of those early years, I would be fairly certain that other of Lilly's plays made their way onto the stage. And then also, as you say, indirectly through authors imitating his dramatic style and his sort of literary technique. So there's a continuity, even if it's not always easy to trace from the records.
Because we have a wider sense of plays being arranged for, shall we say, young men as well as boys. I'm going back in sort of nodding terms. The suspicion is that boys and playing and doing plays is something that's always there in the background and always going on. We do have earlier texts that are designed for boys, and that interesting thing you were saying earlier about how these training methods are good for them, except when it comes to going to plays or being an actor or doing plays for fun is obviously bad and terrible. And there's a really interesting dichotomy between the two. If you've trained doing all of this performance, but you're not supposed to like performance outside of a schoolroom kind of logic. And I don't know if there's anything there to sort of dig around, or whether it's just something that people were not aware of the irony.
It is interesting, and it is ironic, and I think the average early modern person probably would have seen that dichotomy as entirely false, because it's a sort of known fact that these boy actors are drawn from grammar schools and choirs, not least because the boy company plays are full of songs, sort of on average more songs in a boy company play than in an adult company play, or a so-called adult company play, which they were, of course, mixed because they had men and boys performing in them. There's that, but there's also a fantastic moment in a play called The Night of the Burning Pestle by Francis Beaumont, which was performed by the same company, the Children of the Queen's Revels in 1607, where one of the actors is referred to as being one of Mr. Mulcaster's scholars. So it's very likely that that is one of Richard Mulcaster's real-life former pupils who's now performing in these plays. So that's drawing audience attention to the fact that there is this continuity between the schoolroom and the stage, which we see borne out in what the boys are actually doing as well. The kind of transferable skills that they're learning at school. There's a play called Cupid's Whirligig by Edward Sharpham, which was performed by a short-lived company, the Children of the King's Revels, who get set up in 1607. And that has a kind of long Latin lesson, which is staged. So you see the boys kind of mocking their learning and mocking their teacher. And that also happens in a play called What You Will by John Marston, where a couple of lads about town go into a school and try to recruit page boys, but also actors for the professional stage. So there's a kind of in-joke and a shared knowledge that these are practices which are not totally at odds with one another, and that school training and grammar school training bleed directly into the stage, even, you know, in the kind of most physical sense, in that actors are taken from grammar schools to perform in these plays.
Yes, there's something that we've noticed when reading through plays is that, you know, how do you identify a boys' company play without being told in advance? Have they randomly burst into song every act? Is there a sort of emphasis towards parody or meta theatricality in the text? Which seems, and also, is there a certain complexity to the way the action is arranged? And that's something that's quite markedly different sometimes from the Playhouse companies, where rehearsals may be more circumscribed and maybe less directed. It's a question of how directed some of these companies were, in the sense that maybe there's a schoolmaster giving some sort of explicit instruction. But on top of the complexity, there's also a sort of compartmentality to it as well, that you might have certain elements. This is more Lily than I think in some of the later plays, but where certain groups of the plot or certain characters are very confined within their own unit, they may have a very complicated scene or bit of business to do, but they're quite separate from the rest of the action, so that maybe these things can be rehearsed in very separate ways, but also very complex ways, involving a lot of movement, a lot of physicality, a lot of action, that you wonder whether an adult company would actually try within the logic of their repertoire. I don't know if I've run too far on that thought.
I think that's particularly, as you say, in those early plays by Lily, there is this real compartmentalization. And as you say, I think one of the reasons for that is because it's more convenient to rehearse things at the same time or simultaneously, depending on how many people are actually involved in training these actors and rehearsing them, which is never that clear. There are company masters and company managers, but the extent of their theatrical experience is not always particularly clear. And then things become a lot more intersected later on in the later iterations. But there is still a sense in a lot of these plays that there are particular groupings. If you read a few plays that were performed in the same year or in the same season, you can almost notice or guess at particular groups of actors who are particularly good at working together and reappear in, you know, between Marston's early plays, for instance. There's quite often a couple of women who have a lot of repartee and banter with one another. And it's fun to think of those always being performed by the same boys had, if not a specialism, then a particular affinity with one another as performers.
Yes, because Marston plays, they've got quite large casts in terms of, you know, potential bodies on stage, but presumably the spaces aren't desperately large, so you can't necessarily have them all on stage at the same time, or if you do, they've always got to be moving around. And Marston seems to be, it's like Jack Drum's Entertainment, which you look at it on paper and you think, oh, God, how do you stage it? It's too massive, but actually it's a lot of little things happening.
Yes.
And actually it's very manageable when you break it down. And actually, you can sit there, and other Marston plays are similar to that, in the sense that you can actually look at the way you could do, in a more modern sense, very extreme doubling, because very rarely is everybody truncated on stage and doing something with somebody else. Sometimes you have a big scene where there's a lot of people standing at the back, but they often don't say anything. But you'll have a very complex bit of business between three or four people who are really actively engaged.
Yes, yeah, there is a real intricacy to the way Marston designs these plays. And he is a figure who I think was closer than your average playwright to these companies. He becomes a shareholder in, I think both companies. He certainly had an financial interest in both of them, even if he wasn't known as a sharer. So he gets to know these boys really well. First of all, he writes for the Children of Paul's. He wrote several plays for them, and then latterly he's writing for the Children of the Queen's Revels. I suppose, depending on their popularity, the Children of Paul's also disappear. I mean, it wasn't that dramatic, but they stopped performing in 1606. So Marston really has his finger on the pulse as to what boys can do, but he often does give them quite challenging routines. So you mentioned Jack Drum's Entertainment. There is a scene towards the end where a boy dances a galliard, and I think there are 12 other people on stage, and one of the characters actually says, "Oh, you've done very well, but if only you had more room." Mm. And the stage of St. Paul's it used to be thought to be absolutely tiny, but the latest work indicates that it was significantly smaller than an outdoor playhouse stage, but not as tiny as we previously thought. So we don't know where exactly the theatre was located, but the latest research kind of points towards it being on the first floor of the singing school itself. So the room was fairly large, and the stage had fairly capacious, but still, like you say, when you're filling it with all of these bodies, albeit slightly smaller bodies than adult bodies, it can get very crowded and very complicated if you've got everyone moving around at once, which is why you'll often have those demarcated scenes of performance where most characters are simply watching one of the other characters or a couple of the other characters do something more elaborate.
There's a real sense of motion to some of Marston's plays, of these scenes where people just sort of come to the front of the stage, where people move back, and there's a constant motion to it. I'm looking at that as a director going, God, I don't want to block that.
Yes.
I don't want to block that. That looks really hard work. It's a question that comes to also, you know, how often are these companies performing and how often are they turning over their repertoire? Because it's not quite as intense as your playhouse repertoire, which is, you know, changing daily, new plays coming on stream every couple of weeks or so. Do we really have a sense of how often they're performing and how often the repertoire is shifting? Are they swapping performances of different plays, or are they doing a play for a block and then resting it for a while? Do we have any data? Because I know the answer is pretty much no. But are we able to infer some data, some idea of what's going on there?
There are some conflicting accounts, which the majority of which suggest that the boy companies only performed once a week during a playing season. As we get later in the period with the company, the Children of the Queen's Revels, they then move, or they seem to move towards more of an apprentice structure, as well as recruiting students from grammar schools and choirs. They actively kind of go out and seek apprentices who are kind of bonded to the company. And there is a surviving agreement, I think, there that the boys will perform for three times a week. So there may be some variation in practice, but it's certainly the case that they're performing less frequently than the so-called adult companies. And the repertory that we have that survived for all of these companies is far too small to have sustained the company financially. So we probably don't know most of the plays that they were performing. But given how self-referential those plays are and how often they reference one another, it's probably the case that they're performed with fairly regular repetition. But we simply don't have the data, as you say. That, I mean, the best we have to go on are court records, where during a court season, the boys would perform for the Queen and then later the King and Queen. And there it seems that there was some repetition, sort of year after year, the same play would be called for, or it would lie dormant for a couple of years and then it would be revived. So there's variation in practice, I think, but there's not a solid consensus It just seems that it was slightly different from the adult companies, but in what particular way, we can't be entirely sure.
Because that's where the question of complexity and how intensely these are blocked and how they function, where if you're not performing as often or and you're not turning over the repertoire as often, then that becomes more, you know, that makes sense in the sense that you can write this because we have time to do it. Whereas the so-called adult companies would probably go, yeah, nobody's going to learn that in time, mate. Don't do that. And it's interesting what tensions are going on there as writers flip between different companies and plays flip between different companies and what their different demands are. Because, of course, boys' companies indoor performance, they can have an act structure with breaks. So people can walk off stage and then walk straight back on again on as we read it in the script. But, of course, there will be a break with music and potentially there. And those intervals sometimes actually have a structural purpose within the play as well, that, you know, the music may be called for by, you know, and again that sometimes leads into a sort of meta theatrical quality of going, okay, we're going to have some music now from the house band while we go off stage and sort out the next bit. I mean, it's not quite like that, but there are elements sort of like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned plays moving backwards and forwards between companies. There are some instances in which what was previously a boy company play does then get performed by a company like the King's Men. So I'm thinking of John Marston's The Malcontent, which originated with a boys company and then moved to the King's Men and had a new induction written for it by John Webster, which is kind of explaining why it will be a bit different in a theatre like the Globe from the Blackfriars, because there's no, that, like you said, there are no act breaks, there's no music, and it begins with this induction where a playgoer is kind of bewildered that he's going to get a different experience from what he's used to at the boy company theatres. And it worked in the other direction as well. There's some indication in that induction that the boy companies have stolen or in some ways acquired one of the plays that the King's Men have been performing, which is Hieronymo. So it may be the Spanish tragedy or some version of that Hieronymo story. Plays were moving backwards and forwards between, but they did have to adapt to their particular theatrical context when they did so. And things would have been lost, but things would also have been gained, whichever way that direction of travel went. And then later in the period, when some of these boys grow up, well, all of the boys grow up, hopefully, unless they, you know, die young. But a lot of the boys stayed with the theatrical institution and moved to one of the adult companies. And then quite often a play that was associated with a particular actor when he was a boy might move to his new company. So I'm thinking there of the actor Nathan Field, who originated the role of Bussy d'Ambois in George Chapman's play of the same name. And that seemed to travel with him wherever he went into the adult companies. And then when it's performed in the 1630s, after Field has died, they write a new, or it's sometime in the 16, after Field dies in 1616, this play is performed again with a new prologue that explains that it will be different because he has died and the actor who has replaced him can't do the same kinds of things that Field was doing. So it's a kind of apology for Field's death, basically, on behalf of the company. But that play was clearly very associated with him and went with him wherever he went.
Well, this is an excellent cue in for me to ask the question. Tell me more about Nathan Field.
Absolutely. I will take that invitation and run with it. So Nathan Field was recruited to the Children of the Chapel in 1600, and we know that because there's a surviving complaint which has become very famous or infamous in theatre historical circles, known as the Clifton Complaint, which was an appeal brought by a gentleman against the company managers because they had essentially kidnapped his son when he was on his way to school. And that complaint eventually led to them giving the son back, but it also names a number of other actors who stayed with the company. So the language of that complaint is very hyperbolic and talks about the company being extremely threatening. And if all of these actors were indeed kidnapped, then it poses an ethical problem and an ethical kind of question about the theatre and its practices hovers over the boy companies, but in large part because of this complaint. But Field is named in it, and Field at that time, his father had died. His father was, very ironically, a vehement anti-theatrical preacher called John Field. He also had a brother, confusingly called Nathaniel, who grew up to be a printer. Another of his brothers became a bishop. So it was a kind of multi-talented family.
I'd love to be there at Christmas.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And they clearly had very competing agendas. But Field stayed with the theatre from the age of around 12 when he was recruited or kidnapped or impressed or however you want to put it, right up until his early death at the age of around 32. So about 20 years in the theatre. So almost as long or around the same length of time spent in the theatrical institution as some of the famous adult actors. So we know that he performed in Jonson's Cynthia's Revels and Jonson's Poetasta, because when those plays are issued in Folio, they have a very, very partial cast list that say the principal players were, and Field is named the top of that list. So my instinct is that in Cynthia's Revels, for instance, he probably played Amorphous, the kind of shape-shifty role who has a huge amount of physical comedy. And then later in the period, he's named again in the actor list for Jonson's Epicene, where he probably played the role of True Wit, the kind of witty trickster. And witty tricksters was a kind of character niche that Field then went on to play when he moved to an adult company. So the Children of the Queen's Revels actually merged with an adult company, became the Lady Elizabeth's Men in 1613. We find Field there performing in Jonson's Bartholomew Fair. And then in around 1615-16, he moves to the King's Men, where he plays in revivals of other of Jonson's plays like Volpone and The Alchemist. So he played Face in The Alchemist and Voltori in Volpone. So it was a very wide repertoire. A lot of the paper trail is connected to Jonson. And Jonson seemed to be particularly fond of Field. So he described Field later in life as his scholar and said that he'd read, I think, some satires and epigrams by Horace and Juvenal to him. So there may have been some kind of ad hoc teaching going on, but he certainly seems increasingly to have written with Field in mind. And Field was, I mentioned, the prologue to Tapassi d'Ambois, which kind of notes him as a particularly notable actor. But he's also name-checked in Jonson's Bartholomew Fair, not an entirely complimentary way. So that play culminates in a puppet show where a kind of foolish guy from the country, who Field possibly played or probably played, asks where the best actors of the company are and where Nathan Field is. And the joke is that Nathan Field is right there on the stage, and then he's having to watch himself be played by a puppet who's very beloved of the womankind, the puppet master says. So there are a lot of kind of in-jokes to do with his career, but he had a very long and clearly very successful career, moving across different companies, and the kind of collective memory of him as a performer travelled with him. There are kind of very unfunny jokes written about him. They turn up in jest books about how kind of fast he moves. So there's a sense of, we now think of a role like Bussy d'Ambois, for instance, as being kind of very intense and very tragic, but there was definitely a kind of agility and quickness and lightness of movement to Field's performances, which is very hard to capture now. But if you piece enough of the anecdotal evidence together, you can build up a fairly large and capacious picture of what he was like as a performer. And very unusually, there is also a portrait of him, although it was painted when he was an adult rather than a boy.
Mm. So to talk more generally about what happens to plays, what is the centre of gravity to plays where boys are in the ascendant, shall we say? Because there seems to be, or it seems from reading quite a lot of these now, there is an interesting gravitation towards parody a lot of the time. And obviously this is something the authors are interested in, but it seems to be something that maybe is coming from the boys as well. It's very hard if you have a lot of teenage boys to not have them take the mick a lot of the time. I mean, that's sort of what boys do. And I'm wondering whether that's potentially connected to the physicality of boys playing adults, playing women, playing people that they are fundamentally not most of the time. Occasionally you'll have characters who are actually boys doing certain comedy set pieces. But I'm wondering whether there's a gravitational pull with these plays towards certain types and certain kinds of things. So noticing that there are moments of parody, of pastiche going on in boys' plays, But also, yeah, just what's happening with that kind of performance. And of course, we have modern analogs with groups like Edwards Boys. So we have a certain amount of performance in practice research going on today. But do you notice any other centres? I mean, that's just my penny's worth. But are there other centres of gravity where you think Boys Company plays tend to drift towards, or are there other patterns that might be out there?
Yeah, there is definitely a parodic vein to a lot of the repertory, and a lot of that parody is explicitly theatrical. It seems to parody other forms of theatre. So I'm thinking of Johnson's Poetasta. I'm afraid I'm rather stuck on Johnson at the moment, but in Poetasta, he has a kind of braggart captain called Captain Tucker, who appears in one scene with two page boys who he tries to fob off to an actor, or tries to engage in entertainment. And he has them go through this whole series of performances. So they kind of do mini skits impersonating the adult repertory. I think that's, for Johnson, as much a way of mocking the bad writing as it is the performance styles. But that scene culminates in one of the boys standing on another boy's shoulders with a big kind of cloak over him and stalking around in a parody of Muley Mahometan in the Battle of Alcazar. And that was a role that was taken by Edward Allen, who was famous for strutting around and had a kind of very tall stature. So there's a kind of very direct parody there. But I think your instinct is right that occasionally or often there was a kind of pleasure, a comic pleasure, in watching boys playing roles they weren't. And there's a pleasure to be taken in the very obvious mismatch between the body and the role. Although that then gets blurred as the boys get older. So now when we talk about boy performers, it's very easy to imagine little boys. And that was certainly the case when the boy companies were initially set up. So the Children of Paul's, for instance, we have records of actors who were as young as 6 or 7 in the troupe when it was founded. But a boy like Nathan Field is still classed as a boy acting with a boys company when he's in his 20s. So there's a very easy tendency to imagine these as kind of static, but the companies evolved and their repertory evolved as the actors themselves grew up. And what we find with the Children of the Queen's Revels in particular is that they also have a pretty good talent for tragedy. And a play like Bussy d'Ambois, for instance, or Marston's Sophonisba, they're intensely tragic and very dark plays. Mm. And there may also have been some kind of perverse pleasure in watching the effects of those plays play out across younger bodies. And as well as that, the Children of the Queen's Revels in particular were kind of leading the way with tragicomedy. So when Francis Beaumont and John Fletcher start writing for them, a lot of their most kind of experimental work initially originates with the Children of the Queen's Revels. So they could really turn their hands to anything apart from chronicle history plays, it seems. They really didn't go in for those at all. And that may have been to do with the limitations or the kind of spatial dimensions of the playhouse, where you can't have loads of drums and trumpets blaring in an indoor playhouse in the same way that you would with the adult companies. But I think parody and comedy, and particularly physical comedy, are real hallmarks of these company repertories. And like I was saying earlier, that kind of physical education that boys were gaining in grammar schools really pays off in plays by writers like Marston, who occasionally bring actual scenes of sport and gameplay onto the stage. So in What You Will, it's very easy to miss in the printed play because it has no stage directions, but it seems like there's a scene in which badminton is being played, or the early modern equivalent, battledore and shuttlecock. It's a scene that I've been interested in for a very long time, because even the very, very few people who have edited that play don't notice it, but it completely obviously changes the dynamic of the scene if you've got two characters who are having a kind of banterous conversation while they're playing badminton.
Is that the one where they have sort of voiced puh noises? Yes. When they're potentially hitting the starting a service, presumably.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, that's in the printed quarto of What You Will. There are these little vocative interjections in those speeches, which make total sense when you see it being performed, if you can time the line right with the puh. But Marston was very interested always in replicating weird speech patterns. In Antonio Melida, there's a character who really kind of stammers when he's angry, and that's transliterated in the printed quarters typographically and accents and that kind of thing. So yeah, that is the scene that I'm talking about, and it's.
I should note for the listener at home, that isn't my observation. That is an observation I have repeated from your own paper that you delivered about 3-4 years ago.
Yes. Well, it's made its way into the book as well, because I couldn't let it go. But yes, I was involved in a workshop at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse in putting that scene into practice, and it really altered my sense of what audiences are actually looking at when they're watching these plays, because it was about as much about watching a badminton match as it was about watching a scene that was embedded into a narrative. So these plays often seem to go out of their way to draw audience attention to the physical virtuosity of the boys who are performing them.
It reminds me of elements of my training in clown and things with the question of what's the game? What is the game that you're playing on stage? And the game doesn't have to be literally a game like that. But it can function that way in the sense that you may have something else that you're doing as well as the scene that you are playing. And that dynamic and that ability to, it just gives a scene an edge that coming on and saying your lines and being tragic does not necessarily have for it. Another thought, just it's more a Marston thing, but it is very noticeable in Marston and to a degree, I think Johnson as well, is this question of tone, is that switching from one mode to another on a sixpence. I mean, it's theatrically very engaging, where you're going from a scene that is high comedy to immediately something much darker, and that seems to be happening a lot. I don't know whether that's a boys' company thing in general, whether that's more just those particular playwrights, but it does seem to be something that the boys can definitely handle, if nothing else.
Yes, and I think it goes back to this question of variety. That was something that was really valued in actors in ways that is... Well, we still talk about actors being versatile, but that dramatic swinging backwards and forwards between high and low comedy, or high comedy, low tragedy, high tragedy, low comedy, whatever, and how embedded those transformations are in the performing body is definitely something that I think spectators and playwrights valued in boys, who could pretty much do anything, and were willing to give it a go.
Acting has often been described as a young person's game. It does seem to be, in the early modern period, a very much a young person's game. There are an awful lot of actors, you know, who don't make it that old either through just the exhaustion of the certainly the adult repertory system. I mean, it's an awful lot of work that's going on. The advantage that boys' companies have, you know, you have these people, they are full of energy because they are young, and that gives you opportunities as a playwright that you can throw into the mix. I'm sort of thinking back to Lily again, that sort of earlier phase. Also in that sense of something that is strung up very much by an atmosphere, when Lily's doing, you know, very serious material and it's all very beautiful and it's all held together. And then you cut to a comedy scene that is doing something very different. And then you're back to this other mode and switching between, and a sense of unease perhaps is perhaps a mode that flows through. I don't know whether, again, I'm just projecting. I could be just projecting because I'm just trying. I'm testing thoughts in the air. But yeah, these elements that I'm not sure until the 17th century, when I think the adult companies do get more complex in their dramaturgy, because I think they probably got a little bit more slack in the system than the more punkish, shall we say, late 16th century stuff that's going on. I'm just rambling now. So,
you're right. You're right about the kind of increasing complexity as playwrights are. This is still a relatively, I mean, theatre is as old as time itself, but the kind of organised repertory system is still a fairly new theatrical technology, if you like. But the other reason that the plays become more complex is because competition just becomes increasingly intense. So actors and playwrights and companies are in competition for the same audiences and have these kind of strategies of emulation and learn a lot from one another. So we were talking about parody earlier, but I think emulation and kind of appreciative and admiration for what the work that one another is doing also helps drive this kind of sustained increase in complexity and in dramatic innovation. And that can be something as simple as, you know, one theatre has a flying machine, so then another theatre builds one. Those kind of influences also permeate when actors move to from one company to another. So the Kingsmen recruited quite a few boys or erstwhile boys from the Children of the Queen's Revels, John Underwood and William Osler, as well as Nathan Field. They're all named in various documents as moving to the Kingsmen and performing, again, in Jonson's plays written for the adults, but also dozens more besides. So the influences from company to company can be very, very literal and very human when these human resources move from one company to the next.
So there seems to be a thinning out and a disappearance of the boys' companies. How do they end? Why do they end? When precisely do they end? Do they ever end, really, in a sense? Because we haven't been talking about sort of parallel things, you know, that, you know, you have dramas in universities, you have schools still do drama, you know, it's just not quite so organised as this. What is sort of the end point or hinterland of these boys' companies?
It's less of a dying away and more of a restructuring often. So I mentioned that the Children of the Queen's Revels merged with the Lady Elizabeth's Men, and that's to do with all kinds of factors, including financial interest and the transfer of shares and playhouse ownership and all of these kind of things, which I know rather less about than what was going on stage. I'm not really a money man in any sense, and so that kind of playhouse economics aspect is not something that I'm entirely clear on. But that sense, it was a merger which then led to a sort of no further continuation of the boy company tradition. But they do get revived again in the late 1620s and early 1630s, there with a more specific and explicit aim of training up boy performers to then perform in the adult companies. So they're kind of branded as a conservatoire, if you like, to kind of breed new talent. But they, because of financial instabilities and commercial pressures, they don't last particularly long. And by that point, there's more of a proliferation of playhouses and playing companies. So there's just more and more competition. So that's the kind of last gasp of boy company tradition before the interregnum, and then after the Restoration. In the Restoration, the first couple of years, there is what's known as a nursery company, again, with the explicit design of feeding the adult companies with reliable enough boys. But then an edict is brought in 1661 that says that all women's parts are to be played by women. So that's the end of that, essentially, and all of the boys that had trained up and previously taken female roles either had to leave the theatre or start playing male ones, which is what happens with the kind of last great boy actor called Edward Kynaston, who seems to have started in one of these nursery companies, but very quickly is acting in an adult company. So that's kind of the end of that. But like you say, performances continue in grammar schools and universities right across this period, probably even in the interregnum, where, you know, it was all less visible and could have been packaged like it originally was as a form of education and instruction rather than entertainment.
Right. Is there anything else you'd like to bring up or talk about before we wind ourselves to a close?
I mean, there is plenty else I could go on all day, but I think in the interest of time and patience, we should probably wrap it up there.
Do you have any specific plugs you'd like to make or anything you'd like to close about yourself before I close the session?
Well, I will remind listeners that my book, Boy Actors in Early Modern England, is available from all good bookshops and some bad ones, and it's with Cambridge University Press. So if you're interested in this topic, then I would unashamedly direct your listeners in that direction.
And not only that, if you're interested in the more modern iteration, Harry's also written Performing Early Modern Drama Beyond Shakespeare. And I think that's not only a marvellous tome, but also a really good title. Well, thank you very much for talking about boys' companies. That's all for this session. All that remains to thank my wonderful guest for being wonderful. Thank you very much and goodbye.
Thank you.